This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Ellen Bullock, an attorney in Champaign-Urbana. We're going to be talking about international adoption. Welcome, Ellen.
Welcome. Hi, Steve.
Good to have you here. How did you get interested in adopting children in general and then international adoptions?
Well, I have a lifelong interest in adoption. I think a lot of people do. I actually find as I go out and about in life that most people have a friend or a relative that is adopted, or that they are adopted, or that they've adopted a child, or that they've been a birth parent who has had a child that was adopted.
Let me just give a testimonial. My mother was adopted.
And that wasn't unusual at all. And I'm the same way. I grew up with in Minnesota, and my parents, after the Cambodian genocide, the Killing Fields genocide, took in three Cambodian teenage boys. They were called unaccompanied minors, so that would mean that they had that they were older, teenage type age, and had no known living relatives in Cambodia.
Now, how many children did your parents have when that happened?
There were four birth children, and then those three Cambodian boys.
So already had four children, and then they took three all at once, or was it one at a time?
It was two who said they were brothers, but actually turned out to be cousins, and then just shortly after that, a third who was not related to the first two in any way.
How old were you when these three came into your home?
You know, I'm not quite sure. It's kind of in the midst of time, but I was certainly in younger high school, maybe 9th or 10th grade, somewhere in there.
Interesting. Now, that's a sensitive time in a teenager's life. Did you feel that this was a good thing that your parents had done? Were you supportive, or were you a little bit resentful?
Oh, no, not at all. I don't think anybody in our household was ever anything but pleased. Cambodians, the three of them are Sin, Buna, and Chun, and I certainly never felt anything but glad that they were there. I actually think that, I can't remember exactly, but I think I was a little bit the instigator, because I had been working at my school, my high school, public high school, with English as a second language, just as kind of a help thing, you know, in the English as a second language classroom. And it was that connection then that made them call up my parents and ask them if they would take the kids. Because they were literally, it was the Red Cross with Lutheran Social Service. Minnesota is, of course, very Lutheran. And it was the Red Cross and Lutheran Social Service were literally knocking on doors begging people. It was there was a great need for homes for those particular children.
Were your parents Lutheran?
They had been Lutheran. They certainly had that background. They were Swedish Lutheran background. They had another religious affiliation at the time, but they were similar to
What's your family family name?
My maiden name, I'm married now, but my maiden name is Streed, which is S-T-R-E-E-D, as in delightful. And that is actually a Swedish
delightful
word.
Delightful in what, in Swedish?
No, I just spell it that way. That is actually a Swedish word that means battle, of all things. My grandfather was a Gustafsson. He maybe was my great-grandfather. One of my relatives was a Gustafsson during World War II, and he signed up for a regiment. And there were too many Gustafssons because he was in Minneapolis, which was full of Swedes. So he changed his name in kind of a fervor to be a good soldier into Strid, which is the Swedish word for battle.
I see. Now, tell me about this family of origin where your parents had four children, and then suddenly they had seven.
Well, I can tell you about it, Steve. I was thinking about it in preparation for this talk today. I can tell you about it in terms of what international adoption is. I can kind of use it as a way to kind of bridge what international adoption does and is. When a child comes from another country to the United States to be adopted, that child will always have identity, a portion of them that is from their country where they were born. everybody agrees on that I've ever talked to, and it's not very controversial. There's just a part of the child that identifies with the country that they were born in. And then, of course, there's all sorts of factors that impact that. The age of the child when they came, the reason they came. Like, these Cambodians came because their country was war-torn and they were being evacuated from Red Cross camps. That's different. But a lot of children actually come here because there's a condition in their country or a reason in their country that it's better for them to be adopted
elsewhere. Somewhere else.
Yeah. And so they have all sorts of, when they come, they bring all sorts of things with them. From their country of origin, you can kind of start thinking it through. Of course, they would bring a sort of a race or an ethnic identity, but that's actually in some ways the least of what they bring with them. They also bring with them whatever physical impact their early life had, whether they had poor medical care or no medical care, or whether they had different medical care, whether they were hurt or wounded in some way, medically, whether they had a disease or carry a disease. So there's some of those issues. Then also there's, of course, the kind of issues of what their home situation was before they came here. Were they in an orphanage? Were they on the street? Were they in a foster home? And so all of those things are going to come with the child. In international adoption is not a day one adoption. I mean, there's probably exceptions, but I don't know very many of them. Domestic adoption, you can sometimes adopt or at least get custody of the child right away, right when the child's born. Sometimes adoptive parents in domestic adoptions are at the hospital when the child is born.
Sure.
International's different in that way alone. You always are getting a child that's slightly older, and it depends. Sometimes they're 6 or 7 months. Sometimes they're a year and a half. Or sometimes, like my brothers, they're, teenagers. But they always have a past from another country, and they always bring that with them.
Now, you had brothers and sisters before these three came into your home?
Yeah. By birth, there are 2 girls and 2 boys.
Okay.
And I'm one of the girls in the middle. And so the Cambodian boys that came over, their names were Sin and Buna and Chun. And I'll tell a story that kind of illustrates some of the cultural things that come with people when they travel around the world. One of those was Sin came, and he came in the fall. And we lived in Minnesota. My parents lived on a little lake in Minnesota with a lot of trees. And he came in the fall, and the leaves fell off the trees, I suppose. I'm assuming they did every fall in Minnesota that I can remember. Years later, that was the first year he was here. Years later, many, many years later, he told me that first fall when he was at the house, he thought that we had been hit with napalm because the trees were losing their leaves.
Coming from a tropical country and where he'd experienced napalm but not fall.
Right. So he had been really kind of confused that nobody seemed worried about it or nobody seemed concerned about it. And he had actually thought that was kind of scary. So, interestingly enough, that, of course, only happened once. By the second time fall rolled around, he knew enough about it to be prepared and ready and to have learned. But that's the kind of thing that a child could easily not know, and a parent could easily not know to tell them.
Now, what part of Minnesota were your parents living in with their 4 kids? When
outside of the Twin Cities.
Small town? Suburb?
It's kind of... At that time, it was probably the very edge of the suburbs out to the country. Now it's become a very developed suburban-type place.
Now, I've been very moved by a book called Sundown Towns that James Lowen wrote. And did you by chance hear him speak when he was here most recently? He gave 4 lectures. I heard a couple of them. But I'm wondering, in Minnesota... You said you had Swedes in your background. There were a lot of people from Scandinavia, of course, in Minnesota. But was there hostility to these newer immigrants who suddenly came into this high school from Cambodia?
You know, to the credit of certainly of my family and probably the extended area, no, not particularly hostile. Hmm. And but there
were other people of Asian extraction or African American or Hispanic or whatever in your school?
No, I think my family in some ways, and this is kind of a big claim, but maybe everybody in America can make the same claim I'm going to make. I think my family has just in one generation become very, very multiracial. And I think a lot of families in America are doing that. I think my family's doing that at the same time many other families are. Adoption is one way that's happening, although there's certainly a lot of other ways that's happening also. But adoption is a big way that's happening. We were all Swedish, completely, 100%, blonde and blue-eyed and Swedish, and all of us, and everyone around us, and everybody in our classes and stuff. But that's changing. The Cambodians came into our family and changed that. And then the next generation, my brother married a woman from El Salvador, so his kids are bilingual and are El Salvadoran and Swedish. And then I adopted children that are African-American. And my sister has children that are then Cambodian also. So there's just, I think, our family represents what America is doing, which is mixing up. Now, I do want to say with adoption, there's several components to an international adoption that a lawyer has to worry about, and I am a lawyer. The Constitution of the United States of America, no less a document than the Constitution, says that the courts of the United States, both the federal courts and the state courts, have to give full faith and credit to decrees of foreign countries. So usually when a child comes...
What does that mean?
Well, that means that when... It means many things across the board. It means we should respect the laws and the court decisions of other countries. But in adoption, it means that when a child is adopted internationally, say in Korea or in China or in Guatemala, and then the parents, what practice is for an adopting couple or family is to go to that country of origin. If people have had friends who have adopted internationally, they'll go to Guatemala and they'll adopt the child and bring the child home. And then our courts are supposed to give that foreign court decree full faith and credit. So our courts, if we can prove to them that it was a valid adoption in the other country, they have to say, okay, way to go. We'll honor that. And so that's something from the Constitution that sort of gives adoption its base, international adoption space. Now, there's a lot of rules and regulations and funny ways the law works after that, but it's the Constitution that says once you're adopted properly, you can be adopted. Now, there's immigration law, and that the Constitution, that full faith and credit provision I was just talking about, is so stable and has stayed the same for many years. But immigration law, as we all know, is up in flux. Adoptees are subject to immigration law, and that whenever I hear political discussions or ideological discussions on immigration law, I always think of my adoptees and my adoptive families because they will be impacted. Now, there's special visa rules and special visas for adoptees, but it is true they need to go and they need to make Homeland Security happy before they can come over here as a fully adopted child.
I want to get into several of the issues that you've raised, but for people who may have tuned in after we started this program this afternoon, let me reintroduce our guest. Ellen Bullock is an attorney, a graduate of the University of Illinois Law School here in Champaign-Urbana, and before that, a graduate of the University of Chicago. We're talking about international adoption, and this is a call-in program. It's a live show every Sunday night from 5 till 6 here in central Illinois and Indiana. And listeners who would like to ask a question or make a comment are encouraged to call in. Wherever the program is heard, if it's a long-distance call, use our toll-free number. That's 1-800-222-9455. So that's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, you can reach us on a local line. In fact, there are several local lines that if you punch in 333-9455, we'll put you in line and get to you as quickly as we can. We're eager to have people share their experiences, ask questions, make comments. I see we already have a caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with Ellen Bullock. Go ahead.
Hi. I have experience with international adoption. In the 70s, I was living in Germany, not with the military. I'm a Quaker, but on the economy. And my husband and I went with the child that we had adopted in Michigan, who was 10. when we adopted him, and we wanted to adopt a child that was close to his age, and we ended up adopting two German girls who were classmates, and only 3 weeks apart, but they were not related. But the second one came into our family shortly before we returned to the States. It took a long time to get the stuff ironed out with the first one. It took about 4 years. And the second one, she was not an orphan, and her parents had to, they were going to send her to a school for incorrigibles, and we took her first as a foster child. And so they both had to sign, because at that time, at least in Germany, adoption was by contract. So we went to the lawyer and signed our part, and her father signed his part, but her mother disappeared for some time. And so we didn't actually get her a visa. We got her a parole entry. And then she was 13 when she came, but by the time her mother showed up again and signed the papers, she had turned 14. And even though she was in the country before she was 14, the adoption was not final till after she was 14, and so it was never recognized by immigration. And so we were never able to get her American citizenship, and she had mental problems and was just, she assaulted a police officer and went to prison. And when she came out of prison, the INS, this was two years ago, I think, she was deported back to Germany. Where actually, I think she's happier because she never really made the adjustment to the United States. But we were certainly caught up with that, with those immigration problems. And you get in a catch-22 where you're in a legal ring around and you can't get out of it. But I do have a little story to tell about culture. Our other daughter was from an orphanage. She had been basically abandoned by her birth mother had been in three orphanages and two failed adoptive placements by the time she came to us. So she was naturally a little more than a little cautious, but it eventually worked out. But the newer one had been raised in a German family, and in Germany, people traditionally have a boiled egg on Sunday morning. But we weren't a German family. We were an American family, and we didn't, you know, we had pancakes usually or something on Sunday. So she set the table for Sunday morning, and she put egg cups out for everybody because it never crossed her mind that we wouldn't be having a boiled egg on Sunday morning.
Well, that's a very interesting example. Let me let our guest respond to some of that, and thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
And thank you for calling. You know, Germany is sort of rare to have adoptions from Germany, so I'm interested to hear that. Not impossibly rare, but it certainly isn't one of the countries that there's a lot of international adoption going on by Americans, but you were living there, which is a typical way one would get involved in the culture of another country or interested in the culture of another country or interested in adopting, exactly like your family did, by being there and thinking about the issues while you were there. I agree with you. The immigration laws can be a trap, an absolute trap. I think the best answer is caution beforehand, but this isn't an answer adoptive parents can always make. Sometimes, if you've read The Kite Runner, a very popular book, he wants to adopt a child, and there really isn't time to do it all correctly from the United States through all the procedures. It's kind of a desperate situation, and he, you know, needs to, it's fiction, obviously, but I'm thinking about it as if it were really happening. He needs immediate legal advice, and he has to get the kid out of trouble, get the heck out of Dodge, and there isn't just a lot of ways to be cautious. But that said, me understanding that adoptive families can't always practice the caution that I'm going to preach, that's what they should do if they're able. You have to get those immigration issues figured out through a reputable licensed child welfare agency or through an attorney before you do the adoption. And it's a several years process. Adoptive parents spend several years getting ready to adopt internationally, meaning getting ready to comply with the immigration laws and getting ready to work with their agency to get a child.
Now, Ella, the caller's talked about some of the complications that come from adoptions. In the case she mentioned, someone who even went to prison. I mean, people do not always have sweetness and light when they make an adoption, any more than their biological children may always turn out exactly the way they might hope.
Yeah, I recognize that, Stephen. I certainly have heard and talked to many people. On the other hand, oddly enough, as an adoption attorney, I hear an awful lot of just total blubbering joy. People just are so happy. Adoption works best when children find families and when families find children. And a lot of the international adoption going on is people who really want to be a family. They really want to parent. They really want to share their lives with a child. And usually that has a really happy ending, but not always. And the woman who called in, and myself included, have certainly seen very hard things happen to families through adopted children that have problems. Some of those problems they bring with them from their country of origin. Some of those problems were inflicted upon them through no fault of their own, through war or, in utero alcohol exposure or things that the child had no control over, obviously. And in those situations, it's very frustrating and sad, but I think the parents recognize that the child was hurt by somebody and somewhere beyond their control.
We have another caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Ellen Bullock, talking about international adoptions. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, Attorney Bullock. I'm conflicted on an issue concerning adoption vis-a-vis international adoptions. And that is, I know that there are several children groups, demographic groups in the United States, African-American, older white children, probably mentally and physically challenged children, who are waiting somewhere to get a home, probably being shuttled from foster home to foster home, sometimes at great risk. And I'm conflicted that we're pushing or facilitating international adoption when we're not, quote, taking care of our own kids. Am I being unduly provincial in that point of view, in your professional opinion?
Hello, and I think I'm speaking to a very esteemed person, Professor Fred Harris. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yes, and Professor.
Welcome to the program.
Professor Harris was my professor when I was at the law school. He taught me environmental law, which is another one of my lifelong interests, the environment. And I appreciate your call, Professor Harris. I think you're making an excellent point. And let me say something about American children and domestic adoption, because obviously I practice there too. In fact, the bulk of my adoption practice would be domestic, although I certainly love and enjoy my international work. But yes, domestic adoption, we do have children in the system, absolutely, undeniably. Champaign, Illinois has a heavy, heavy load of children, just like you described, older white children, older African-American children. Usually infants of any race, and this might come as a surprise because it was different 10, 20 years ago, infants of any race, healthy infants of any race, really there's not much problem getting those placed at all. That one, they wouldn't.
In this country or around the world?
In this country.
Okay.
I don't know about
around
the world. Okay. And but we do have a responsibility to care for our own children. But I think we do both at the same time. I don't think necessarily one precludes the other. There are right now, and has been for several years, certainly the time I've been in practice, DCFS has pushed adoption of its wards over foster care and has kept its subsidies static, meaning the same. It's amounts of money that it gives for the care of the child and nurture of the child, and the medical health card, the most important, the medical insurance, has kept that the same, whether adoption or foster. So right now, and it's working as best it can, but right now there are certainly a push for adoption of the children that are in our own system. And there's always room for improvement, but I do a lot of that adoption too. I do those kinds of adoptions all the time. I love doing them. I do DCFS subsidized adoptions on a regular basis, and I love to do them. I see my kids, my adoptees, I think of them as my kids, I see them out and about. They send me their pictures. I'll go to my child's choir concert, say at Centennial High School, and I'll just look through the risers and I'll see 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 of the kids I've done adoptions for. So there is a lot of domestic adoption going on. There's always room for more. I you know, there's always a child who needs an adoptive home. And so you're absolutely right, and you're not being provincial and you're not being rural. Right here in Champaign, Illinois, there's a child that needs an adoptive home, and anybody who is feeling the least bit inclined to do that should do it, because it would be a wonderful experience for them.
Well, Steve, I want to say this to the radio listening audience. Attorney Bullock was one of the best students I had at the University of Illinois College of Law.
Well, I'm not surprised. As a University of Chicago graduate before that, we could just assume brilliance, right?
I think you'll be right on with that one. Thank you all.
Thank you. Appreciate the call. Ellen, how old were the children that you adopted, you and your husband, when you adopted them?
I think they might be listening. And so hello to Kyle, Imee, and my youngest, Charlie. Kyle was approximately 10 months old when he came into our home. And Imee was approximately 2 weeks old when she came into our home. A couple little stories that I hope they won't mind me sharing on the radio, but they can call in if they wanna cut me off. Kyle was about 10 months old, and the way that Kyle came, the timing of his arrival into our home was actually based on my law school graduation. I had wanted a child very much and wanted to adopt a child very much, and so my husband and I were very much looking forward to adopting a child, and had registered with DCFS and with the agency and gotten our home study done and everything you need to do to prepare for an adoption. And we had been very conscientious and done it early, but we had decided that we would wait till I was done with law school. So we told the agency we were working with, well, Ellen's going to graduate from law school on May 15th, so we want to adopt a child after that. So we got Kyle on May 19th, so that was really a fun timing. That was the perfect timing for
now,
adoption.
What was your spouse doing while you were in law school?
My spouse is a professor. My husband is a professor at the University of Illinois in agricultural economics.
And he already had that position while you were in law school?
Yes, I came here with him.
Uh-huh. I see. How did the two of you come to the conclusion that you wanted to do this?
Well, I don't think the two of us are that interesting, but I've heard since I've become an adoption attorney, I have to say I can share just a bunch of really ton of interesting stories on why people want to adopt. It really is a nifty question. Steve, you're being a good interviewer and asking a good question. Sometimes when clients come into my office to talk about adoption, I'll do the same thing you're doing, ask questions to get good answers. People adopt for all sorts of reasons. I think some of the best reasons for adoption that I've seen or heard from some of my clients and are that just for the joy it will bring them to have a child and to know a child and to get to know a child and get to be intimate with a child over many, many years. And that is just something wonderful, and people come in all excited about that. And then, of course, they do get that child and they get to experience that. Professor Harris, who called in earlier, callers, made a good point. That is an excellent point. A lot of people adopt because there are children that need homes. Infertility is certainly a reason for adoption. And infertility
there seems to be more of that than ever before.
I was going to say infertility is growing worldwide. I heard some stats. I can't quote stats ever. I'm abysmal at quoting stats. But I heard some stats that basically boiled down to the sperm count in, like, Finnish men is going down, you know, by billions per whatever. So there's just some really strange things happening with infertility, and that is certainly one of the driving forces behind adoption. But it's not the only force behind adoption.
Let me repeat our phone numbers for others who'd like to make a comment, share an experience, ask a question. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. You can access several lines by punching that into your phone. If it's a long-distance call, if you're listening anywhere in the continental U.S., including on the Internet, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455 to have a toll-free call. And, of course, WILL can be heard on the Internet live at will.uiuc.edu, and then going to AM 580 and clicking on the way to listen through your computer. So you can hear the program. This program is heard a number of places by people listening online. And of course, if you've missed part of this program and like to hear it, it'll be archived at that same website. So WILL.UIUC.EDU, and then go to AM580 and look for Keeping the Faith. And the programs will be there for a long time, and you can hear this program if you missed part of it, or perhaps you want to recommend it to a friend. We're about halfway through our program. We have another caller I see. I'll get to that in just a moment, but let me take just a minute before we get back to Attorney Ellen Bullock. And I might, Ellen, spell your whole name for us.
Ellen, E-L-L-Y-N. Bullock, B-U-L-L-O-C-K.
O-C-K, great. And we're talking about international adoption. Ellen will be speaking at the University YMCA as part of the Friday Forum series this Friday, October 26th. That's at noon at the University Y. Remember, that's on Wright Street on the corner of Wright and Chalmers, easily accessible by bus. Or there are parking spaces that tend to open up on Fridays before noon. So do come to hear her, meet her. She'll be talking about international adoption in a multicultural America. This is part of our series on Citizenship Without Borders. And we've had a number of wonderful speakers in this Friday Forum series. And Ellen Bullock is up this Friday. Following that will be Patrick Keenan, and then Baruz Gamari Tabrizi are the next three speakers, the last three speakers in Friday Forum. At Tenor University this coming week, we have a real treat, a musical treat. Professor John Dee, who's the Nugent Professor of Music in the College of Music at the University, and a professor of oboe, will be playing and talking about the oboe, a fascinating instrument in the orchestra. So a free concert, if you will, and explanation about this wonderful instrument, October 23rd at the Y at noon, part of the Know Your University series. And then moving toward a digital library will be the topic of October 30. And some fascinating information on the world water crisis from Derek Winstanley, who's chief of the Illinois Water Survey, on November 6th as part of the Know Your University series. Those are all programs coming up at the Y. They're free. You can get a good Thai lunch when you come. Or you can bring your own food or simply come and listen to the lecture and ask questions. Coming up on WILL later this week are particularly two programs of interest to people who listen to Keeping the Faith. On Thursday, the Afternoon Magazine, about 2:45, James Campbell, who is a missionary of the United Methodist Church, and a pastor of a Methodist church in Anchorage, will be talking about the Campbells of the North River. That's Thursday on the Afternoon Magazine here on WILL. And on Friday, the next day, David Inge will be talking with Forrest Church, who is a pastor and rather well-known writer of All Souls Church in Manhattan in New York. He'll be talking about the Founding Fathers and the first great battle over church and state. So that'll be 11 o'clock Friday the 26th here on Focus 580 on WILL, AM 580. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I'm happy to be talking with Ellen Bullock. Ellen, tell us how can people contact you if they would like to pursue further an international adoption or an adoption of someone here in this country?
I am the owner of a law firm called Law Office of Ellen J. Bullock, and it's in the old train station downtown Champaign, and I practice in adoption. I also do some civil rights litigation and some plaintiffs litigation, but I certainly focus on adoption and do a lot of adoption. They can look me up in the phone book, Ellen J. Bullock, Law Office of, and I would be delighted to serve them professionally.
All right. And we'll go to a caller who's been very patiently waiting. Thank you. On line number one, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. My wife and I have been married for just about a little more than a year, and we're talking about adopting a child from Ethiopia. And we don't meet two of the criteria they typically have for adoption. I'm 49, and they say that you need to adopt a child who's less than 45 years younger than you. And also, we've only been married for a little more than a year, and they suggest you need to be married for 3 years, I believe. In your experience, are these rules hard and fast, or can you petition around them?
Well,
what's your advice for us?
Well, you've brought up a really interesting question, in fact, a fascinating question. And it's probably frustrating to you. You're saying, well, I don't care if it's fascinating or if the woman on the radio thinks it's fascinating. It's frustrating to me. I'm a good dad. Why wouldn't I be a good dad for a little Ethiopian baby? And there are thousands of them that need homes. And it's true. There are Ethiopia, particularly right now, has really, really, really a lot of children who could become adoptees and benefit from adoption. There, it's a problem. The criteria you're talking about are a problem.
Whose criteria are they?
They are the other countries, the country of origin. And every country, again, we have to give full faith and credit to these foreign adoption decrees. I said at the beginning of the show, the United States is taking in children after they have been properly gone through the adoption proceedings of the foreign country. So if the foreign country says you have to stand on your head for 20 minutes, you really do have to stand on your head for 20 minutes. Now, petitioning is not a bad idea. And you should always feel free, I think, to say, can't I, for these reasons, become a home for a child? But I'm not that hopeful, and it's too bad. Some of these criteria are pretty arbitrary. There's age criteria.
Yeah, they vary a lot from country to country, I take it.
They vary a lot from country to country, and they don't always, in my mind, seem to impact whether you'd be a good parent or not. And but they do their own thing. Some countries are very strict about single parents adopting. They will not allow it. No way, no how.
And China now won't let people adopt who are of the same gender.
And most countries don't. Illinois does allow partner adoptions. That's an interesting legal issue. And Illinois does allow partners to adopt. But no, many of the internationally do not. And they don't even allow single parent adoptions. So there are some criteria. Age is one. You just mentioned it. And there's even weight criteria. Korea has a body mass index criteria. You have to be under a certain BMI or body mass index so that you have to not be obese, basically.
Huh?
And both parents, both adopting parents. So there are criteria. But, sir, you asked your question back to give you a little bit of hope instead of just giving you a blah, blah, blah. There's other countries, and maybe you need to look at another country. I wouldn't really advise, as a practical matter, I wouldn't advise taking on the country's rules. I certainly would never counsel a client to lie. Don't do that. So don't try to get around their rules in any way other than either by, you said, petitioning honestly and saying, this is why, even though I don't meet your criteria, I'd still be a good parent, or going to another country. And I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry there are some restrictions that don't make a lot of sense, but
Are there some other African countries, for example, you think of immediately that might not have these two requirements?
There are many African countries, but it's interesting. Ethiopia is kind of one that's growing. Adoption happens from countries all over the world, and this is maybe as good a time as any to talk about the Hague.
Let me just follow up with this caller. Caller, did you want to ask anything else before we learn some more from our guest?
I guess I was just wondering if there were other African countries that she knew of, that Ellen, if you know of any other African countries that don't have these kinds of age restrictions, I'd like to know.
Yeah, I think there are some. I'm trying to look at my little list here. I actually brought a list with me, because certainly Ethiopia is one of the Africa countries that is doing the heaviest amount of adoption right now. I think the Congo is doing some adoption. I'm not sure what their restrictions are. And I think...
Is it easy to find out these kind of restrictions, or is that so arcane it's just difficult to learn it until you get into the process?
No, what this gentleman who's calling me has probably done, and reasonably so, is contacted a licensed child welfare agency.
Okay.
LifeLink is one here in the area that does a lot of international adoption. There are several others. But a licensed child welfare agency would be the place you would start even before your attorney. You will eventually need an attorney, but you're going to start with the licensed child welfare agency. And they have their agency has a connection with an agency in the country of origin. And so that's there. I know that some of the South American countries adopt and don't have that age restriction. And the marriage one is a little different. That one you could kind of wait out. I think that there are marriage restrictions. The 1 year is a little short, but I think at 2 years there's certainly a lot of countries that allow adoption. You can start now, and by the time you'd get in line, you and your wife would have been married the required period of time for quite a few countries, I think. And your age will not preclude you from adopting. There are children for you to adopt, and it's no reason for you to give up being a parent because your age doesn't meet Ethiopia's requirements. There are many, many countries. I'm thinking of Guatemala. I'm thinking of Korea that allow adoption. Russia and some of those countries, I can't always remember which ones, but many of the countries that were the former Soviet Union that allow older married couples to adopt.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for the question. Very helpful. We're talking with Ellen Bullock about international adoptions. Ellen is an attorney in Champaign, Ellen J. Bullock, a law firm. Ellen, tell us a little bit about your background. We found out about your family of origin, but tell us about your law experience. Why did you choose this specialty when you came out of the University of Illinois Law School?
Well, Steve, I don't think I actually chose it, but it kind of grew on me. When I first got out of the University of Illinois College of Law, I taught at the law school for several years, and then I clerked for a federal judge. So it wasn't actually a straight route. I went into private practice about 9 years ago, and that's when I started building my adoption practice. And I started building it for a couple reasons. One is that I really, really like adoption law. I'm fascinated by it and still am after all these years. And another is that it's a law that I can do well at. I can help people out. A lot of law is very it's adversarial and controversial. Adoption usually isn't, although I have been involved in some contested adoptions, and I get more experience. I get asked to do some contested adoptions. That would be an adoption that reaches litigation. So you would have a birth parent or two adoptive couples competing for the child. Those are very painful cases.
Sure.
But usually adoption is not that. Usually adoption is not adversarial. You go into the courtroom to form a family, which is a really happy way to go into the courtroom and a really nice way to go into the courtroom. You actually notice it all over the courthouse. The judge is in a better mood. Everybody's a little bit enjoying adoption law a little bit more than other types of law. The rest of my practice is litigation and civil rights law and things like that, and those can get very hotly contested. It's nice to have adoption work, which if you're thorough and careful and conscientious, by the time you go to court, it's pretty secure that you will get exactly what you want.
I've been interviewing interesting people on this program for 8 years, I guess, and I haven't interviewed that many attorneys. Tell me a little bit about how an attorney is really trained. I mean, you go to law school after undergraduate. It's a 3-year program. You went to the University of Illinois. It's one of the esteemed colleges of law. Do you get any experience while you're in law school? Is it all just hearing, being in class?
Certainly my adoption work, I didn't learn a thing in law school, and you really wouldn't. It's a specialty that's kind of small enough that you wouldn't have a lot of training in law school. But that said, law school gives you what you need to know about the courts generally and about how the law works. So Illinois adoption law is governed by federal statutes, a few, not very many, mostly by the Illinois Adoption Act and also by, like I said, the United States Constitution. And you learn in law school how to use the law. So the fact that I didn't study the Illinois Adoption Act isn't so amazing. The fact that I did study law, statutes, how to read them, how to apply them, how to go to court and learned how to go to court is probably more important as a lawyer.
Now, when I was in seminary, and they still require this, you get some practical experience by actually working, it might be a summer or something, with a pastor in my case. Do law students do this? Do you have internships? Do you have
They're optional. Steve, you mentioned yours. You had to. We don't have a requirement that training lawyers do that, but certainly Their summer internships are very highly valued. I did two summer internships. One I did with the National Wildlife Federation and environmental law, and the second one was with Hopkins and Sutter, which was a large firm in Chicago. And many law students do what I did, which is take advantage of summer internships.
Huh. And so you might be with others, law students, in those internships, I tell you.
Yes, and I actually, my claim to fame, the National Wildlife Federation, I loved the work I did there. That's probably one of the high points of my whole life, not just my legal career. I really loved working on those environmental issues. But I also, when I was a law clerk, summer intern for Hopkins and Sutter, the law firm, I met a young man who was at Harvard, and he was the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Law Review, and his name was Barack Obama. And I had a summer internship experience. I sat next to him in the library.
What year was that?
That would have been the summer of 1990, sorry. Huh. And then I graduated in 1991.
So what was he like as a law student? Was he impressive even at that age?
He was very impressive. This is getting really far afield of adoption law,
sorry,
but he was very, very impressive. And he was just, even back then, a very just incredible presence, charisma, and intelligence back then. So.
Huh. Interesting. Well, let's get back to our main topic. We're talking about international adoption, and Ellen Bullock will be giving a talk about that at the Y Friday Forum this Friday noon at the University of Y. If you'd like to reserve a lunch, do call the Y, 337-1500. And we'll have a lunch for you when you arrive. You can pick your, look at the menu and see what you'd like. That gives us some idea how many folks might be coming. Tell us how prevalent international adoption is these days here in the U.S.
Well, it's very prevalent, Steve. I even brought some statistics. The statistics vary every year. They actually keep statistics, of course, because every child who's adopted has to go through immigration and be issued a visa. There's very clear statistics of how many children are adopted each year. Every year the top country changes around. There's several that kind of vie for first place. Russia, China, and South Korea are always near the top. In a year, I think this is the stats I have here for 2005, and I don't have the 2007 stats yet, but for 2005, I'm looking at them. Russia, there were 3,816 children adopted. China, there were 3,597. And South Korea, there were 1,654. And so there's, it goes there from there. There's also Guatemala, Romania, Vietnam, India, Colombia, Philippines, Mexico, Bulgaria, Haiti, Latvia, Brazil, Ethiopia, Lithuania, Poland, Bolivia, Hungary, Cambodia. Now, one thing you will find is that in the United States, different regions do more of one country. Like, you might have a heavy concentration of Chinese adoptions in a certain area. And that can be just because the agencies are set up and working and running and they're getting a lot of babies from that area. Or it could be that people, you know, have friends. But there's a lot of international adoption going on, quite a bit of it.
How many cases will you have in a year?
I don't really have those statistics in front of me, but many. People come to me again when they already have their child. Once in a while, they have a problem, an immigration problem, beforehand, and I might refer them to another attorney, or if I can handle it, I would handle it. But certainly when they come back to the United States with the child, they're going to want the Illinois courts to stamp that this is a full and final adoption. And one of the main reasons they're going to want that is they're going to want a new birth certificate. And Illinois will give a new birth certificate when you have the proper paperwork from an Illinois court. Again, the adoption can sometimes children, like in India, in the case of India, very highly prevalent adoption country for many years. We've adopted from India for many, many, many years. In India, the children are given to the adoptive parents under guardianship, court-ordered guardianship, not court-ordered adoption. So then the Indian child comes back with the family to the United States, can come to some, you know, POSOTM or something like that. And then the family will work on the adoption from POSOTM of the Indian child. In China, everybody knows this, but there's some interesting things. In China, you'll see almost always when you see a Chinese adoptee, it will be a female adoptee. Not always, but almost always. And that is, of course, because of China's policies. I consider them completely bizarre policies, although they certainly make for nice adoptions, of not wanting girl babies. I don't understand that. I think it's bizarre. But it turns out then that here in the United States, we get just these wonderful, beautiful, delightful little girl babies from China, and we just keep getting them year after year.
How much does it cost to adopt a child internationally compared to adopting a child from this country?
International adoption is, and this I can say for sure, there's so many things that are just kind of for sure. International adoption is much more expensive than domestic adoption, although the domestic adoption can be more expensive. But your typical domestic adoption is less expensive than your typical international adoption. For all kinds of adoption, there's a federal tax credit, and this is fairly new. Some people who adopted 10 or 15 years ago might hear me say this and say, darn, I never got that. There's a federal tax credit of about $2,390. That's an approximate amount. And there's some other criteria that have to be met. But that is a tax credit for adoption. So what that actually does is subsidizes the adoption. International adoption, they have to file a financial affidavit saying everything they've paid for the adoption when they go to court. They can range. They can be very high. They can be maybe $22,000, $23,000 total, or they can range up to $45,000, $46,000 total. And like I said, about $10,000 of that will come back in tax credit if you meet the other criteria. But the rest is borne by the family. So it's expensive. And domestic adoption would, of course, usually be a little bit cheaper than that.
How much would that cost?
Well, domestic adoption is really interesting because it doesn't have to cost anything at all. It can actually be quite free. A lot of the adoptions I do, maybe guessing, but maybe 30% of the total adoptions I do are DCFS adoptions, and those are subsidized. And so the attorney's fees are paid by the state of Illinois, and the child gets a monthly subsidy and a medical card. So those are completely free. Of course, it costs money to raise a child, and so everybody who adopts knows when they hear me talking about the adoption costs, they know those are just the beginning. Once that you have a child, then there's lots more costs of raising the child, but that's all right. We all are ready for that.
And there are a lot of benefits.
Wonderful benefits.
Tell us some.
Again, with my work with adoptive families, and I've been in this about 9 years, and I'm starting to see my adoptees and their families out and about in the grocery store and on TV and in the news and in the newspapers. And there's just I have heard so many times, I wish I had kept track of it. I wish I kept a little chart in my office the first time somebody said to me. But I bet I've heard 100 times, maybe 200 times, maybe more, I couldn't love that child more. There's no possible way I could feel more love for that child. And like I said, I haven't heard that once or twice. I've heard that 100 times. And men tell me that too. Women are a little more frequent in telling me their feelings, but men tell me the same thing. People just are incredibly satisfied with the family that adoption forms. They are very happy with it. Obviously, there's some problems. Certainly, adopted children could have a problem, a medical problem or an emotional problem that needed care or needed treatment. And I think every adoptive family has probably thought about that or given attention to that. But it is just a wonderful experience. Adoption brings joy, just a lot of joy. To people's lives, into the children's lives, into the parents' lives. And again, I hear so often parents saying, I learned so much from adopting. I learned so much about this child and about their background and about loving a child and raising a child. And then if the adult adoptees, they don't talk much when they're teenagers about this, but adult adoptees will say, you know, it was wonderful. Our family was wonderful. We had all sorts of different children. We had children from different countries. We had children by birth and children by adoption. I couldn't have had a more wonderful childhood.
You talked very positively about the benefits of interracial society, interracial families. Are there problems with that?
You know, Steve, I read the same book you did about the sundown towns that you mentioned earlier. Of course, there are sort of problems, unbelievable problems present in our society, and I know about those. I think everybody does. The listeners that we have listening to us today know about those, too. Transracial adoption, which international adoption can be transracial. It's not always transracial, but it certainly can be. But transracial adoption, whether it's international or domestic, makes a multiracial family. There's just kind of a simple way that a multiracial family is formed. Of course, marriage can be another way that a multiracial family is formed. But transracial adoption is a forming of a multiracial family. I think of those children as bridges between cultures. They have a really valuable function. Our society needs bridges in between cultures, and these children are uniquely suited. They're almost sort of miraculously suited to become those bridges. So I think that those children serve our society. They just offer a wonderful service to our society. They bridge gaps. They bridge cultural gaps. They bring people together. Of course, there is the other side of that. You have to protect the children. You can't break their backs by walking over the bridge too often. I think you can, and our society does benefit from the way they bring people together.
What are the problems with siblings when there's an adoption?
Same as the problems with siblings when there's not an adoption.
So sometimes there can be jealousies, sometimes there can be rivalries.
Right. And many times when you have adoptions, sometimes you have adoptions of sibling groups. So then a birth family, a birth siblings will be adopted into a family as a group of siblings. But more often in adoption, there will be siblings, but they will be of different birth backgrounds. And that'll either be through they were adopted at different times or from different places. Like one family will adopt three children, 2 years apart, and those children don't share any birth or genetic characteristics. Another way that families mix it up is that a lot of families have birth and adopted children in the same family. It is really not uncommon at all that a family will come to me after they already have birth children and want to adopt, or that they will adopt through me and then tell me soon thereafter, next time I see them, and now I'm pregnant or now I'm having a baby.
We've been talking on Keeping the Faith this week with Ellen Bullock, who is an attorney in Champaign-Urbana. Her office is where again?
I'm in the old train station downtown Champaign. It's called Law Office of Ellen J. Bullock.
B-U-L-L-O-C-K.
Yep.
And thank you for talking with us about international adoption. Ellen will be our guest at Friday Forum this October 26th at noon at the University Y. If you'd like to hear her talk about international adoption in a multicultural America in that kind of a setting, and actually get to meet her and ask her questions in person. Coming up at KYU at the University Y this week, Know Your University, is John Dee. He'll be playing the oboe with a piano accompanist and talking about the oboe. That's this Tuesday, October 23rd at noon at the University Y. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I'm the director of the University Y, and we do have a vehicle donation program. If you have a car, truck, pickup truck, motorcycle, boat, anything with a title, consider donating it to the Y. It helps us and will help probably a student. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
They can talk to angels, they're intuitive, and their aura is an unusual vivid blue. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll find out about indigo children. The New Age movement says they're here to save the world. Modern medicine says they're normal kids. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s and south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour, with gusts up to 40 miles per hour during the evening. Tomorrow, increasingly cloudy with a chance of showers, cooler with the high in the lower 70s, and northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour in the afternoon. Tomorrow night, colder with showers likely, the low in the mid-40s.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
It's 6 p.m.